Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Irish Studies, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. My name is Aidan Beattie. I'm one of the co-hosts of this channel. Today we're talking to Patrick O'Malley, professor of English at Georgetown University, where he teaches Irish and British literature of the long 19th century, as well as critical theory. He is the author of two previous books, Catholicism, Sexual Deviance, and Victorian Gothic Culture, published by Cambridge University Press in 2006, and Liffey and Leth, a Paramnesiac History in 19th Century Anglo-Ireland, which was published by Oxford University Press in 2017, and also won the Robert Rhodes Prize for Books on Literature from the American Conference for Irish Studies. His new book, published at the very end of last year by the University of Virginia Press, is The Irish and the Imagination of Race, White Supremacy Across the Atlantic in the 19th Century. And if you're interested in reading it, there's a discount code for 40% off the price if you just use the code 10OMALLEY with UVA Press, which will be valid for a limited time, I understand. Is that correct, Patrick?
That's correct. That's what the press has told me.
And in general, thanks so much for joining us to talk about this book, about a somewhat timely topic, I guess.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Aidan, for that introduction. And I'm really delighted to be talking with you and joining this podcast.
Sure. So I guess for a lot of people, maybe more broadly in Irish studies, when they think about questions of whiteness, they might naturally go to Noel Ignatieff's book, How the Irish Became White, which I think is now seen as maybe a little bit as an overly polemical book, along with maybe Theodore Allen's book, The Invention of the White Race. And there's obviously a lot of literature about this kind of question, right? Did the Irish become white when they moved to America? And there's maybe more sophisticated, less polemical people like David Roediger and Nell Irvin Painter who've written on this kind of topic. Where do you situate yourself into that kind of work?
Right. Thanks, Aidan, for that great introductory question. I think I'd like to actually start by giving a kind of overview of the book and then moving toward that question in particular, since it's one that runs through the entire book. So this book focuses on writing primarily from the 1840s to 1850s, although some earlier and later in the century, that brings together questions of Irishness and race, and in particular, in terms of the ways in which Irishness was brought into a sort of analysis of comparison and contrast with Blackness. So I focus on Irish writers like Mariah Edgeworth, Thomas More, Dion Boucicault, John Mitchell, on British writers writing about Irishness and race like Matthew Lewis, Thomas Carlyle, Matthew Arnold, and on American writers taking up the question like Hosea Easton, Frederick Douglass, Asenath Nicholson, Edgar Allan Poe, Frank Webb, and William Grayson. And throughout the book, I'm interested in moments of solidarity, but I'm also interested in ways in which false equivalencies can disrupt that solidarity and obscure the need to acknowledge the specificity of Black experience. And so that really brings me to your question about Ignatieff and Allen, who are obviously important contexts for the work that I wanted to do here and are in a lot of ways where I started when I began thinking about this book. And so one thing I'd want to say up front in relationship to your question is that there are some really important ways in which I think the argument of my book actually aligns with the arguments of Gnatiev and Allen, in that it's an axiom of this book that race is constructed rather than essential. Race in both the 19th century and now is a really incoherent category, as any glance at U.S. Census designations demonstrates. And racial categories, so what falls inside and outside of them, vary from period to period and culture to culture. The medievalist scholar Geraldine Heng has a really good description of this, where she points out that pre-modern, even pre-modern racial thinking doesn't require a set of a priori racial categories, but in fact produces races in answer to specific historical imperatives. So in that way, I think I'm thinking about the kinds of questions that Ignatieff and Allen ask, that is specifically in terms of how is whiteness constituted? How does whiteness get imagined? And how does it work particularly in terms of Irishness? And I think that I would agree with them that if there was a period before which the category of racial whiteness wasn't operative, and I think that that's true, then at some point every group of people that we, that is within a specific cultural context, think of as white must have become white, as Ignatieff puts it. And it's also, I think, important to recognize that whiteness is itself constructed and not simply a transhistorical normative category. But in this book, and this is where I think I'm trying to shift the conversation a bit, I wanted to press on these, on three questions that I think get in the way of jumping from that basic axiom of the construction of race, at some point that whiteness itself is constructed, to the sort of argument that Ignatieff made. First, once the category of whiteness emerged, were the Irish in particular excluded from that category in a way that made them broadly analogous to groups understood as non-white and in a kind of unique way as opposed to other white ethnic groups? Secondly, did they, the Irish in particular, become white in the 19th century? Is that the point at which this happened? And thirdly, did they become white in the context of the American racial regimes, whereas they were understood as non-white, or that whiteness wasn't similarly operative in the context of the United Kingdom? And I think that those are really fair questions. And I think that those are really important questions. And there's been some great work engaging with those questions. Part of the issue is that the whole question of what the term race even means and how it might be different from a term that we use like ethnicity, but that wasn't used in that sense in the 19th century, is really important. And it's definitely the case that a lot of the language that we use for race crystallized in the 19th century. And because of that, there is a sort of flurry of questions like, wait, are the Irish Caucasians? How do we know? What does that even mean? And it's also the case that the brutality of the 19th century American racial state was fundamentally different from the situation in the United Kingdom, both culturally and legally, which is something that Frederick Douglass famously observed in the 1840s. And finally, I want to be clear that I'm in no way discounting the horrible conditions of life for many Irish people in 19th century Ireland, conditions produced by and sustained through colonial violence, including the famine. And stigma and discrimination certainly continued in both the United Kingdom and the United States. But while we need to acknowledge that violence, the oppression that marks Irish and Irish American history, I think that we need to be careful about analogizing the situations by suggesting that the 19th century Irish were treated or understood as though they were Black. And that is, I want to avoid a misleading conflation between the forms of discrimination and hardship experienced by the 19th century Irish in both the United Kingdom and the United States, and the racist violence enacted against Black people both during and after the legal institution of American slavery. And I think that if we sort of casually ask about what, you know, why the Irish needed to become white, while that doesn't necessarily suggest that the Irish situation was cognate to the condition of Black persons, it sometimes tends to suggest that. And that's what I want to avoid. It seems to me specifically to disentangle those, to insist on the specificity of Black suffering and Black resilience, and to show that even if 19th century Irish writers claimed that they were being treated in the same way that enslaved Black people were, we need to understand differences. And I think that that some of that misleading analogizing slips into the work of scholars like Ignatieff and Allen, and some, although certainly not all, postcolonial Irish studies that has been produced in relationship to or built on that work. And that's where I think the, as you pointed out, the sort of work of amazing scholars like Painter and Roediger and O'Neill, and I would also add David Lloyd and Mary Mullen and Amy Martin and Alicia Walters, has been incredibly generative and inspiring to me. And that's in the spirit, that's this sort of the spirit of this book.
So I might ask another question about a thing that runs through your entire book. Is you're making a in some ways a quite complicated argument about how genre, like literary genre and race in terms of as a social category, not necessarily that they are conflated, but that they are analogous to each other's cautiously in some ways, or that they reproduce each other in some ways. Could you kind of talk us through that? What exactly is the argument? Because I don't want to kind of do injustice to it by trying to reproduce it myself.
Thank you for that question. And you're absolutely right that that is, I think, an important part of what I'm doing in this book, although in a couple of different ways. I think I would say part of the complexity is that there are maybe two principal ways that I'm thinking about the intertwining of literary genre and race in this book. And the first is a sort of structuring framework for the book. And this was a way of organizing materials, I would say, that helped me think about how to put Irish and American writers and literary works into conversation with each other. And I'm a literature guy. I like thinking about the work that literary form, including genre, or sometimes maybe more particularly mode, does. My first book was on the Victorian Gothic, so I'm interested in thinking about the relationships between forms and cultural effect. So I started thinking about categories that by the middle of the 19th century had played key roles, literary categories that had played key roles in Irish literary nationalism, some in expressly iconic ways and some more tangentially. And in my book, that list includes categories like the national tale, the bardic epic, the gothic, the stage melodrama, the sentimental novel, the polemical tract. And I was interested in what happened when Irish writers, particularly Irish nationalist writers, deployed these genres to write about race in the American context. So these had been genres that had become really sort of central to Irish nationalist literary expression by the middle of the 19th century. So what happens when they're kind of like moved out of that world and into a different world? And what struck me was that they often seem to trip up on this question of analogy between these categories. And I want to say that one of the sort of important terms in the book I take from the Afro-pessimist scholar and writer Frank B. Wilderson, and he's got a term sort of like the ruse of analogy, sort of like the ways in which analogy causes us to think about things that are fundamentally different as comparable or equivalent or conflatable. And so I was interested in sort of like this ruse of analogy once you move a genre from one place to another. And I started to wonder whether we might think of that as both a kind of intellectual and moral failure and a formal failure. That is, that the genres through which this early 19th century rhetorical fight for Irish rights in the United Kingdom, the genres in which that fight was waged were understood in a kind of too rigid way or too comparable way or too transferable way for these writers to effectively translate these liberationist convictions into the context of the American race-based chattel enslavement state and the white supremacy that produced it and outlived it. So there's a kind of literal and literary understanding of genre and its relationship to 19th century understandings of race. I mean, it is I've structured the book around particular literary forms of expression and formal categories. But as I was working on the book, I realized that there's a second and probably more fundamental way in which genre and race speak to each other. And that's that they both name ideologically inflected categories that are culturally constructed and that are deeply influential in the ways that we understand the world around us. They articulate and they enforce really powerful forms of relationality. They make us think about analogy in particular kind of ways that I wanted to disrupt or think about disrupting in this book. So on this, I would want to say that this was something that I started reading about more as I was already writing the book and had already decided to think about structuring the book in terms of literary genre. And this was something where scholars in critical race studies and particularly scholars of color really helped me think about the ways in which categories of race and categories of literary genre speak to each other. And these are scholars like Yogita Goyal, Brigitte Fielder, Mark Jung, among others. And at the same time, a scholar like Joe Rezek has done some fantastic work in exposing the ways in which print forms in the late 18th century and early 19th century were themselves increasingly racialized. And so I started to think about that, right? To sort of like think about category as both enabling, but also potentially problematic if we start to assume that we can conflate across difference in this way, and so those are the kind of the two kind of ways I was thinking about this, and I guess to that I'd maybe add a third, which is the historical and the sort of historical development of in the 19th century. Of understanding linguistic expression as being related to racial categories, and there, you know, for example, we might think about the ways in which a term like Indo-European shifts from naming a linguistic category, a kind of genre of language, to naming a racial category. So that's the larger kind of like theoretical and historical argument about the relationship between genre and race. And I think what I came to believe and want to argue is that the particular that these various ways of thinking about the relationship of genre and race are themselves in conversation with each other. That is, that the particular literary genres and modes that I focus on are salient to the Irish imagination of race in part because of these larger linguistic, literary and historical structures.
Mm-hmm. So I might dig into maybe one of the specific genres that you start with early on in the book, which is Gothic Irish literature. And you focus on that by looking at obviously questions of Irishness and race, but then looking specifically at the work of Edgar Allan Poe. And on the one hand, I think some of that is quite familiar, I think, to an Irish studies readership, right? That the Gothic novel is an Irish type of novel and that it is a very racialized novel. Edgar Allan Poe seems a little bit less familiar, maybe. How does he fit into this?
One thing that I've been seeing more of lately in Irish studies, but also in American studies, is more attention paid to Poe's ancestral Irishness. His paternal grandfather was born in Ulster in the mid-18th century and migrated to Baltimore. And one place that I would point to for this is Mary Burke's really excellent recent book on race, politics, and Irish America. And I know that you know this book well because you've interviewed her on this podcast. And Burke, I think, very compellingly identifies a category of what she calls Scots-Irish Gothic as a particular instantiation of this kind of like broader question of the relationship of Irishness to the Gothic. And she includes Poe centrally in that category of Scots-Irish Gothic, but also other figures that I think it's really revelatory to me to put together in this way as she did. And those include Charles Brockden Brown, Henry James. I would say in some ways, John Mitchell into this category. So on the one hand, we could think of Poe in relationship to a kind of ancestral Irishness, rather than just being a kind of quintessential unmarked American writer. Then on top of that, Poe seems to have been sort of obsessed with Irish literature. He was reading a lot. He read a lot of Irish literature. And as we might expect, he was particularly interested in what we might think of as sort of like Irish genre literature that he could think of in relationship to the kind of work that he was doing. So he satirically refers to Charles Robert Maturin's Melmoth the Wanderer in his preface to his 1831 collection of poems. And he had a real reverence for Thomas More as well. Reportedly, the last book that Poe read before his death was Moore's Irish Melodies. And this made me think that Irishness maybe is more relevant to Poe than we've often sort of assumed when we think of him just as kind of like an American writer or a Southern writer. Mm-hmm. And so for my chapter on the Gothic and that then moves to Poe, I focus on the Gold Bug in particular, which takes place in South Carolina. It includes a central Black character, and it's been the focus of some important analyses in terms of Poe and race by Toni Morrison and many others. And what hooked me on the Gold Bug for this project was the fact that Poe uses an epigraph to the story from the 18th century Irish playwright Arthur Murphy. So my question in the chapter is actually very much like the question that you just asked me. What does Irishness have to do with this tale of mystery, encryption, and American race? Why is Murphy the epigraph to this chapter? And does Irishness in that sense matter for this story? And then as I'm writing about this one, you know, there's actually an added twist that Poe misidentifies the source of his epigraph. It is in fact Murphy, but he gets the play wrong. And that got me thinking then about mistranslations between seemingly similar things, failures of alignment, misleading decodings, sort of like ruses of analogy, which are actually at the heart of my argument about the treachery of analogy between Irishness and Blackness in 19th century studies and in the way that we might think about how the Gothic is functioning. But generally by the middle of the 19th century, but also in particular in a writer like Poe.
So I might move on then to the next chapter in your book. You talk about a man called William Grayson, a congressman turned poet, not as well known a figure as Poe, I think it's fair to say. And you focus on a 1500 line epic poem he wrote called The Hireling and the Slave. And as you point out, the poem is not exactly high literature. But what does a poem like this reveal about all of these questions of genre, race, and Irishness that you're exploring?
So I'd like to begin my answer to that question by saying I'm not going to make any claims for Grayson's poetic abilities. And his racial views are worse. For quite a while, he was erroneously credited with coining the term the master race. And the Oxford English Dictionary still actually lists this poem, The Hireling and the Slave, as a key instance of that usage, although it's now found in earlier appearance. In the mid-1850s, the poem, perhaps unfortunately, didn't simply disappear. It went into a number of editions. It got some critical attention. And in some ways, it's actually the banality of the poem, both in its conventional literary form and in its the banality of its racism, that's both most telling and I think most horrifying, in part because it expresses a sort of bog standard form of American anti-Black racism. And for Grayson in this poem, the Irish precarity is brought into conversation with the question of Black enslavement, but it's brought into conversation in a way that expresses the fundamental difference in Grayson's argument between white labor, including white Irish labor, and Black enslaved labor. So within Grayson's racial system, which again I think is banal in a way that makes it symptomatic or telling, within Grayson's racial system, the Irish who are oppressed, discriminated against, subject to labor violations and all kinds of things, don't need to become white. There's no need for them in Grayson's vision to become white. They are white. And that is the assumption of the poem. It's the whole point of the poem. And that's actually not, I think, a new development in the 1850s. Grayson's title, The Hireling and the Slave, is taken from the third verse of the Star Spangled Banner. It establishes a division of forms of labor across a white-black dichotomy that is sort of absolute in a way. We might remember that Irish immigrants were always understood to be free white persons in the terms of the 1790 Naturalization Act in the United States. And here's another place where I think that Roediger's work is important. Roediger writes about the language of the hireling and the slave in the 19th century. And he analyzes this complex relationship between race and class, between racialization and labor. And in that, I'd say he's like rather than unlike Allen and Ignatieff, although in a more nuanced way. And I think I would largely agree that the development of capitalism is fundamental to the modern construction of race, that modern understandings of race don't precede capital, but are produced by it. And that's also how I read the argument of Karen Fields and Barbara Fields in what I think is their really amazing book, Racecraft, The Soul of Inequality in American Life. But to say that race is constructed as a sort of ruse of capital doesn't mean that the effects of it are comparable across different forms of racialization, or that anti-Blackness can be reduced to a question of social class, or that Irishness is analogous to Blackness. And Grayson's poems, I think, demonstrate that point. For Grayson, the whiteness of the Irish is not something that they need to achieve, but is why their precarity and their suffering matters to him in a way that Black precarity and suffering don't matter to him. It's the predicate for his understanding of Irish precarity. To me, it's actually a sort of interesting and symptomatic aspect of the poem, in how invested in Irishness it is. And Grayson represents his interest in Irishness as not just limited to Irish America, but as a sort of transatlantic cosmopolitanism. He alludes to the famine. He alludes to colonial oppression of the Irish in Ireland. He quotes Thomas Carlyle on Ireland. In Chicora, which he publishes a sort of pendant poem to the hireling and the slave, he invokes the Ossian poems as a kind of Celtic antecedent for his own work. And that's one of the reasons why I think that Grayson's poems are relevant to my book and kind of like thinking about genre and generic transformation, because they not only transform Celtic modes into American verse, but in part by doing that, by bringing those, what Grayson sees as these Celtic modes into the American literary context, he's arguing for a sort of transatlantic master raceness that is explicitly predicated on Irish whiteness. Mm-hmm. So that I think is the sort of like key reason why Grayson matters to this mm-hmm. book.
So as you're kind of across the whole book, as you're talking through all these problems of Irishness and race and how conceptions of Irish whiteness move back and forth across the Atlantic, it often seems that Frederick Douglass is almost like a recurring character within the narrative of the book. And I'm wondering, like, for you, what does he reveal about these questions, but also what have people gotten wrong about him? There's often a lot of this kind of analogizing that's quite simplistic that you're critiquing that people engage in when they talk about Douglass.
Yeah, absolutely. Douglass is central to this book, central to basically every chapter of the book, I would say. And as I think you're suggesting, there's a way in which he's also central to the how the Irish became white argument, for a number of reasons. I wanted to think about those. There's a famous passage from an 1846 letter from Douglas to William Lloyd Garrison. While Douglas was writing from Ireland, he was doing a lecture tour in Ireland. And in this letter to Garrison, Douglas says that he's sort of astonished by the way that he's treated like an actual human being in Ireland, with all the deference and the kindness and respect with which white people are treated. And there's another famous passage in My Bondage and My Freedom, where he writes that the singing of enslaved people in the southern United States was unlike anything that he'd ever heard, except the singing of the Irish during the famine when he was in Ireland. And then back in the United States, he repeatedly notes that Irish immigrants and Irish Americans offer some of the most virulent anti-Black racism of any American groups or immigrant groups. So that can easily look like a sort of narrative of the Irish taking on whiteness only once they reach the United States. But I wanted to complicate that a bit or think more about that or contextualize it. By noting, among other things, that his point in the letter to Garrison isn't that the Irish in Ireland weren't white. And in fact, he calls the Irish white in that same passage when he's writing about the Irish who he talks to. The point there is that white people actually can treat black people with kindness and respect, not that they're not white in doing that. And he actually wrote quite a bit more about Irish people in Ireland than those two passages. And I wanted to look at those other instances. And one of the things that I was struck by is that there was a kind of occurrence that shows up in accounts of Douglas's tour in Ireland that shows up with a kind of depressing regularity in the reports from his lecture tours in Ireland, is that Irish people kept on coming up to him and thanking him for his words, and then telling him that they were particularly appreciative of his lectures because the Irish were also enslaved. And Douglas keeps on having to say, like again and again, there are these reports where he's like, no, in fact, you aren't enslaved, right? That yes, your precarity matters. Yes, I want to support people who are discriminated against in all kinds of ways. But there are terrible forms of anti-Irish discrimination that aren't the same as the enslavement of Black people in the United States. And that is, he keeps on, not only in the United States, but also in Ireland, having to address what I'm seeing as these sort of forms of false equivalency, right? And I'm wanting to foreground those passages as well, and to look at the ways in which I think Douglas is incredibly astute about both thinking about how coalitions can be forged between different groups of people, but then also why the differences between the historical conditions of those different groups of people are important to keep at the forefront of our minds while we're forging those coalitions.
Mm-hmm. You end with two figures that are fairly well known, at least their names are fairly well known to Irish studies scholars, even if their works are not, John Mitchell and Dean Boucicault. And Mitchell is almost takes the complete opposite tack of like no desire whatsoever to build coalitions with African Americans. I mean, he's both shockingly racist, and I think it's fairly well known that he was shockingly racist. How does he compare with Boucicault?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you asked that question, because it's actually the seed from which the book sprouted. In my previous book, which was about 19th century Irish literary historiography and the problem of accounting for unresolved historical violence within the framework of literary genres that seemed to demand closure, I had a section about Boucicault's play The Vampire in relationship to the famine. And I briefly mentioned Mitchell in that context as well. And while it wasn't something that belonged in that book or that I had time to think about in that book, I became a bit obsessed with what seemed to me to be uncanny parallels between the travels of these two Irish Protestant writers. So both arrive in New York City in the last months of 1853. In 1855, Boucicault temporarily moves to the enslaving state of Louisiana, and Mitchell becomes a farmer in the enslaving state of Tennessee. In 1858, they're both in Washington, D.C. Then they're both back in New York at various overlapping points in the early 1870s. Both wrote in really different ways about American slavery, although in quite different genres. Both considered the American racial state in relationship to Ireland. And both ultimately seemed to me to sort of like get some things wrong about the relationship or non-relationship between Irishness and Blackness in ways that I found somewhere between intellectually lazy and morally appalling. but in incredibly different ways from each other. So that was actually the knot that I was sort of like trying to untangle, trying to pick at that started this book. And one thing that they kept coming back to was this difference in genre between the way that they were thinking and the ways that genre shapes how we see and understand relationality between forms and categories. So if your genre is the political polemic, as Mitchell's predominantly was, the sort of like ruse of analogy works in a certain kind of way. If your genre is stage melodrama like Boucicault's, it works in a different way. I also think that you could come at this from the other direction. David Theo Goldberg distinguishes between two types, what he identifies as two types of racial thinking that he calls the naturalist and the historicist types of racial thinking. And for Goldberg, the naturalist mode goes from Hobbes to Carlyle. And that's where I'd probably put Mitchell. And the historicist mode goes from Locke to Mill. And that's where I would kind of like think of Boucicault. I'm not 100% convinced that those labels that I'm taking from Goldberg really work for Mitchell and Boucicault, at least as I'm thinking about them here. But the way of thinking about these sort of like generic ways of thinking, that was important to me. So Mitchell, you're absolutely right. It in a way kind of like utterly fails to see the possibility of coalition between Irish nationalism and anti-slavery activism, people like Douglas and others. But he absolutely sees, and he argues for, an analogy between Irish nationalism and the Confederacy. And he presents absolutely his argument for the continuation of race-based chattel slavery in the United States as a version of his Irish nationalism. He doesn't seem to present these as different arguments, but as the same argument. So he is thinking within a kind of like weirdly generic way about analogies between things. So in the book, I tend to present Mitchell as appealing to what I see as sort of like genre as schema, as sort of schematic relationship between things, and Boucicault as thinking about genre as a particular kind of genre as sympathy, also about relationality between things. And it struck me that in these two different writers, kind of like types of thinking about race in these different ways are in some ways amenable or produce particular generic forms. So it's not just that Mitchell happened to write about race in the form of political polemic and Boucicault happened to write about it in the form of the stage melodrama. Those forms fit the kinds of arguments that each makes, but at the same time, they also shape and delimit and restrict the possibility of these arguments. So Mitchell starts to see everything, including people, in terms of oppositional categories: Ireland, England, the Confederacy, the Union, whiteness, blackness, and he draws these schematic equivalencies that line those categories up. So he opposes the Union of Great Britain and Ireland, and he similarly opposes the American Union. The Confederacy is the Ireland of the United States. Therefore, enslaving human beings becomes for him a form of Irish nationalism. Black people, by virtue of their blackness, are for him subject to slavery, whereas Irish people, by virtue of their whiteness, deserve self-determination. And as you say, it's shockingly racist, but it's also, I think, symptomatic. And then, I mean, your question about Boucicault, I think, is a really good one, and kind of like how is Boucicault like this, or how is Boucicault different? And I think that Boucicault is different. And in my account of Boucicault, the chapter focuses primarily on Boucicault's play with its title that I think is deeply uncomfortable to us now and should be uncomfortable to us. The title, The Octoroon, which he wrote in relationship to his time in Louisiana, that I think for Boucicault, the key term is sympathy, which is a term that he himself describes and theorizes to some extent a number of years later in an essay called The Art of Dramatic Composition. Now, he's nowhere near the kind of forthright, even self-congratulatory racist that someone like Mitchell is, but he's a pretty slippery character, I'd say, in terms of actual political commitment. And he plays both sides of the abolition debate, depending on where he was and what argument he thought would sell more tickets to his plays. And sympathy, I'd say, has a racial component in terms of who's inside and who's outside, the circle of identification that makes sympathy possible. And my argument about the play is that Boucicault presents Zoe, who's the central enslaved character in the play. He presents Zoe's individual fate as tragic, but he's ultimately unable to argue that the enslavement of Black people in general is wrong. And that's where I see these kind of like two different ways of thinking causing problems or causing challenges for both Mitchell and Boucicault. So while Mitchell is so blinded by abstraction that he can't see human suffering and the human suffering that his own arguments are advancing, Boucicault can't get beyond the individual object of sympathy. And he presents what's happening to Zoe's tragic, not really because she's 1/8 Black, but because she's 7/8 white. And so he's also, in a way, unable, I think, to construct a truly ethical relationship between Irishness and Blackness. But he's not a moral monster like Mitchell.
That's a nice way of putting it. Maybe just as a brief kind of concluding question, I know your book is obviously quite tightly focused on mainly on literature from the 1840s and 1850s, but where, what would you see as the after history of all this? Where does this politics and literature of white Irish grievance go later in the 19th century and as we come into the 20th?
Yeah, thank you. You're absolutely right that the focus of the book is primarily the 1840s and 1850s, and I wanted to keep it in a relatively tight historical moment for a number of reasons, not least, of course, because of the migration of Irish people to the United States during and after after the famine, because of the lead up to the American Civil War, because there was a lot of sort of anthropological theorizing about race going on in these decades. So there was a lot, there's a lot about these, about this particular period that I think it's worth slowing down and thinking about. But the patterns that I look at here certainly didn't stop with the Civil War. An early title for the book was From Last Conquest to Lost Cause. And that was drawing a line from Mitchell's Irish nationalist polemic, in particular his book, The Last Conquest of Ireland, perhaps, to the rhetoric of neo-Confederate nostalgia represented by the Lost Cause. And I'm fascinated. There are some things that I do mention in the book that move a little bit beyond on this period. I'm fascinated by the fact that Oscar Wilde, during his 1882 lecture tour of the United States and Canada, visited the aging Jefferson Davis in Mississippi. Wilde was apparently reading Davis's Rise and Fall of the Confederate Government during his travels, and he expressed a desire to meet with Davis. And after the visit, he was quoted by a newspaper saying that the case of the South in the Civil War was, to my mind, much like that of Ireland today. That seems to me a really interesting sort of like aftermath of these kinds of questions. And it's a rather different representation of the relationship between Irish anti-colonial activism and the American racial state than we often imagine. I have a sort of coda to the book in which I look at Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind, in the early 20th century as a reconstruction of Irish nationalism in the United States that I read is explicitly predicated on white supremacy. But it's also the case beyond what sort of like the content of the book itself. It's the case that I started writing this book in a kind of horror at the ways in which Irish precarity was once again now being mobilized by far-right groups as a tool of anti-Black racism. The reappearance of the Irish slavery canard, which shows up in the 19th century, especially among young Irelanders like Mitchell, seems to have again become central to white supremacist propaganda in a number of ways. And the false equivalency that undergirds that myth is, I'd argue, a modern instance of the ruse of analogy that I'm tracing in the mid-19th century. And I wanted to think about that, but also call it out, and to be careful about where this goes. But I also wanted to make another point about this, and this is a sort of like disciplinary point in a way, and that is that while the alt-right Irish slavery meme is, of course, based in shoddy conflation and outright forgery of the past, one thing that struck me as I started writing this book was that I could also see its basis in some actually quite good and influential Irish studies scholarship of the 1980s and 1990s. Some of that is the work of labor historians like Allen and Ignatieff, with which we started this conversation. And some of that is the work of post-colonial Irish studies folk. And I want to be clear that what alt-right trolls are doing with that work is a distortion and a misrepresentation of important theoretical accounts of Irish racialization. But it also occurred to me that it should be a wake-up call to us in the academy, to those of us in the academy who care about racial justice, to maybe be wary of making our own somewhat under-theorized equivalencies between the experiences of Irish people and those of Black people, even if those equivalencies are well-intended. That we can build coalitions, scholarly coalitions, both inside and outside the academy. We can build coalitions for justice across race without erasing the specificity of Black experience through analogy. And so one thing that researching and writing this book has taught me, and I guess as we're closing up, one thing that I'd most like to share here is that I think that when we in 19th century Irish literary studies are writing about race and racialization of Irishness, we need to start listening more to writers and scholars in African American studies and in Black studies more broadly. So we need to read more of Douglass than a couple of short passages that compare Black and Irish precarity and deprivation. And we need to read more 19th century Black writers on this question. Samuel Ringgold Ward, Hosea Easton, there are others. We need to read what Harriet Jacobs wrote about Mitchell, for example, amongst other things. So we do need to be reading more of these 19th century writers. But then also contemporary work. If anyone has the chance, try to see a production of Brandon Jacobs Jenkins and Octoroon, which is both a homage to and a critique of Boucicault's play, and which I think is a brilliant and absolutely spit-take funny analysis of race and genre and the grip of the Victorian past on the present. So if you have the opportunity, see that. I would say, yes, of course, we need to continue to read these foundational post-colonial and class studies texts of the 1990s, but we also need to be reading Saidiya Hartman, Sylvia Winter, Vanessa Dickerson, Christina Sharp. And we need to get ourselves out of our own ruses of analogy and start building ethical coalitions that acknowledge fundamental differences of experience, even as they strive to build a more just world across them. There are some great scholars in Irish studies who are doing that now, we need to read them as well. And that at least is my hope.
Great. Well, as I think I said at the very start, as what you're saying here points to, this is an incredibly timely book and a very important intervention into Irish literary studies. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed talking with you today.